Deborah Heart and Lung Center presents Dr. Daniel Ice. He is a talented interventional cardiologist at Deborah Heart and Lung Center. And our last visit, I do recall we had a great program on PAD. Today, we're going to be talking about atrial fibrillation. You often hear it referred to as AFib. Understanding AFib and stroke with Dr. Ice this half hour on Deborah Heart and Lung Center presents Dr. Daniel Ice, an interventional cardiologist and is board certified in cardiovascular disease, interventional cardiology, nuclear cardiology, adult echocardiography, and vascular medicine. My goodness. That's incredible. Dr. Ice earned his medical degree at the University of Louisville School of Medicine in Kentucky. Notice I said Louisville. Dr. Ice, I got a little cred there. After medical school, he completed his residency in internal medicine at Indiana University School of Medicine. He also completed fellowship training in both cardiology and interventional cardiology at Lankenau Medical Center in Wynwood, Pennsylvania. Dr. Ice's special interests include structural heart disease, complex coronary intervention, peripheral vascular intervention, venous disease, and chronic total occlusion, also referred to as CTO. He has authored numerous articles in peer-reviewed medical journals, and it is my pleasure to welcome back Dr. Ice to his program. Welcome, Dr. Ice.
Thanks. Thanks, Harry. Thanks for having me. And way to nicely pronunciate Louisville.
Thank you.
In the native tongue.
Thank you for pointing that out. So let's get right into it. What is AFib?
So atrial fibrillation is the most common arrhythmia marked by an irregular and often rapid heart rate that is triggered in the upper chamber of the heart called the atrium, which is why it's called atrial fibrillation. And this heart rhythm basically is where the heart is fibrillating rather than being in a normal what's called sinus rhythm. The arrhythmia is not a life-threatening condition itself, but is a risk factor for stroke. AFib can increase the stroke for a patient by 3 to 5 times the normal rate of stroke for most other individuals.
Now, we have two headliners this half hour, as you know. What is stroke?
So a stroke occurs when blood flow to the brain is disrupted, which prevents brain tissue from getting the oxygen it needs. When this occurs, the brain cells can even begin to die even within minutes. Most commonly, strokes can be caused by a blocked artery, but it can also be caused by a burst blood vessel in the brain. When it relates to atrial fibrillation, it's typically caused by a blocked artery. A patient having a stroke can have a variety of symptoms. They may be confused. They may slur their words, may not be able to understand speech. They can have numbness either in their face or even in their arms or legs. Can even lead to paralysis in these areas. They may have problems with sight, being unable to see in one or even both eyes. They can have trouble walking. So there can be a variety of symptoms that are completely abnormal for that patient.
Is it normal to have symptoms, whereas you'd have an opportunity to perhaps, and sometimes I know it requires the person that you're with, all of a sudden if they hear you speaking a certain way and, you know, it doesn't sound right, you can sometimes see that an event is happening right then and there. But do you usually get some type of warning where you could then seek help, or can this just happen with no word, no notice?
Right. This often can happen with no notice. Symptoms just begin. And it's really critical for either the person or those individuals around that person to notice it and to call 911 immediately.
Our topic this half hour with Dr. Ice on Deborah Heart and Lung Center Presents is understanding AFib and stroke. And Dr. Ice is going to be sharing a lot of very important information. If you're dealing with any of these issues or any of the different items that Deborah does so very, very well in heart and lung and the sleep diagnostic, they do so many amazing things. To make an appointment, you can call 609-621-2080, 609-621-2080, or digitally any digital device at demanddeborah.org. Dr. Ice, what is the left atrial appendage in the heart, and what is its function?
The left atrial appendage is kind of like a finger-like extension or sort of a pouching out of the upper chamber of the heart called the atrium. Basically, it's one of the upper chambers, and there's almost like a little extra pouch that hangs off of this in the back of the heart. The exact role of this appendage is somewhat unknown, but we do know that it does release hormones into the bloodstream that can help regulate blood pressure as well as blood volume. It may also help decompress the left atrium during heart contractions.
Now, there's a reason that we brought up for our listeners, we didn't just pull left atrial appendage out of the sky. Why may people with AFib, Dr. Ice, have risk for stroke related to the left atrial appendage?
When people have AFib, the irregular fibrillations of the atrium causes blood to basically pool in the atrium, particularly in the atrial appendage. And as this blood pools there, it can form blood clots in the appendage. And we do know that about 92% of AFib-related strokes are caused by blood clots that originate in that left atrial appendage, move out of the appendage, travel up to the brain, and cause a stroke.
Wow. Something to be very mindful of. Dr. Ice, why may people with, let me go to treatment. We're going to come back to that question later in the hour. What treatments are available to prevent blood clots that you've been talking about from forming in the left atrial appendage?
Traditionally, we have used blood thinning medications for AFib patients to thin the blood to prevent those blood clots from forming in the heart. The most common medication for a long time was warfarin, or sometimes called Coumadin. But about 10 or 15 years ago, some newer, more reliable blood thinners were developed, which made it easier for patients to thin their blood without many of the inconveniences of warfarin. And many AFib patients have benefited from that. Many AFib patients have essentially been switched over to these newer, possibly safer blood thinners. But for many patients, they can't tolerate being on a long-term blood thinner due to issues with bleeding or falling or some other reason. So fortunately, medical technology has allowed us to have an alternative option where we can actually go in and occlude the appendage with a small device and essentially seal it off.
Wow.
And these devices are called left atrial appendage occlusion devices.
How does it work?
These are catheter-based devices, meaning that they are delivered into the heart using a small tube called a catheter, which is advanced from a large vein in the groin all the way up through the heart and into the atrial appendage, that pouch that hangs off the heart that we spoke about earlier. These devices are released into the entryway of that appendage and are basically anchored there. These devices will physically block any clots that form in the appendage from moving out of the appendage and traveling up to the brain to cause a stroke. Additionally, over the next few weeks after one of these devices are placed, the patient will form a new layer of their own heart tissue over the surface of this device, which will effectively seal off the appendage, blocking blood from entering and exiting out of the appendage.
Wow, that is amazing, isn't it?
It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
It's amazing where technology has led us these days.
We only take one break. We'll do it right now during Dr. Ice's time with us here on Deborah Heart and Lung Center Presents. Dr. Daniel Ice, interventional cardiologist. The topic this half hour is understanding AFib and stroke. To make an appointment at Deborah Heart and Lung Center, I'll give you the phone number. You can call, or if you like to do things with your computer, your smartphone, whatever, iPad, whatever, laptop, any digital device, you can certainly go to demanddeborah.org, or you can call and you'll see the link. It's a red block hyperlink, and it will take you right to the information to schedule an appointment. Or you can call 609-621-2080. We'll be back in just a little bit. Don't go away. One more power segment straight ahead with Dr. Daniel Ice, interventional cardiologist at Deborah Heart and Lung Center. Again, the topic this half hour is understanding AFib and stroke. It is Deborah Heart and Lung Center Presents. Dr. Daniel Ice, interventional cardiologist, and the topic this half hour is understanding AFib and stroke. And when we left you, we were talking about this left atrial appendage occlusion device, LAAO, device and how it works. And I think it begs the question, Dr. Ice, who is a good candidate for this device?
Well, I think candidates for this device really are AFib patients who cannot tolerate blood-thinning medicines, at least for the long term. Typically, because of a history of bleeding events, whether it's GI bleeding events or some other form of bleeding, who might otherwise be at a high risk for falls, maybe because they're unsteady on their feet. In addition, by far, those are probably the two highest reasons on why we do this procedure. But over the last couple of years nationally, we're starting to see more patients asking for and receiving these devices due to lifestyle issues, such as higher risk occupations or hobbies that may expose them to having a major bleed if they were ever to injure themselves. So we're starting to see a slight uptick in those type of patients coming in for the device. But again, the majority of these patients are people who cannot tolerate long-term blood thinners.
Dr. Ice, is the atrial appendage occlusion device, is this one device or are there multiple devices that are available?
There are two FDA-approved left atrial appendage occlusion devices currently in the U.S. right now. One of them is called the Watchman device, and the other is called the Amulet. They have two different designs, but effectively do the same thing. However, since atrial appendages come in different shapes and sizes, having two different designs to choose from allows us to be able to successfully close more patients, particularly patients that may have unusual or difficult appendage anatomy.
To help folks, please continue.
There's a couple other devices that are currently in trial in the U.S., and we may see another third device becoming FDA approved in the next year or two, but currently there's only two.
My follow-up was going to be, and I'll pose it now, Dr. Ice, is this the type of thing where it's personal taste, or is somebody more suited for one versus the other when you consider a certain case?
It's really, it's probably 80% of cases you could use either one. It's really on a personal level based on their anatomy that we look at using most commonly a cardiac CT to look at their appendage, the shape, the size, the orientation of it to decide if one might be more preferable than the other device.
Dr. Ice, tell your listeners about the atrial appendage occlusion procedure. How invasive is it? Two-part question. And what's the recovery period?
Sure. It's certainly still called a minimally invasive procedure. It is not surgery. The procedure starts by having an anesthesiologist put the patient to sleep. We use some form of cardiac imaging during the procedure to help guide us to visualize the appendage. We use a special kind of echocardiography camera that is placed down a patient's throat or their esophagus so that we can visualize the appendage. And then using small needles, we can enter into a large vein into the groin, advance a catheter up to the heart, cross through the heart to the appendage, and then ultimately release the device in the desired location. This procedure usually takes about an hour or so. And then after the procedure, the patient wakes up and is monitored for several hours. Many of these patients will go home the same day. Some patients may spend one night in the hospital and ultimately go home the next day.
Is this the type of device that just works, or is it monitored?
Certainly we need to monitor it to make sure we have a good seal, to make sure that we're confident that we can take a patient off their blood thinners. Basically, to prevent blood clots from forming on the device after the placement, we'll have the patient remain on some type of blood thinner for about 6 weeks after the procedure to allow time for that patient to form that layer of tissue over the device that I spoke about earlier. And then to ensure the device is occluding that appendage and that there's no small leaks around the device, the patient will need to come in and have what's called a TEE procedure done at 6 weeks' time. That's where, again, the patient is put to sleep. They have that special camera put down their throat, and we can visualize the appendage and make sure everything looks good. If everything looks good, then we typically will stop the major blood thinners and switch over to more minor blood thinners for about another 5 months. And then normally we'll have the patient come in for a 6- and 12-month follow-up visit.
I was going to ask you about follow-up. You just covered it. So if you have the atrial appendage occlusion device procedure, that's folks listening right now that maybe are taking blood thinners and are thinking about, you know, different options and things, that's the course that you would go through. It sounds very, very reasonable.
Yeah, I think for many patients, if they're on blood thinners and they're tolerating them okay, then I would suggest just staying on those. But for many patients who can't tolerate them for a variety of reasons, some of which we spoke about earlier, then I think it's great that now we have an alternative option that we can offer these patients.
Regarding, and you could break this down into two questions, AFib and stroke. Are a lot of folks that deal with this, is it familial, the heredity, or, you know, what's your experience relative to who has issues with this and who doesn't?
Well, there's certainly risk factors for atrial fibrillation patients in terms of what their stroke risk are. Many of these risk factors include whether they have congestive heart failure, high blood pressure, whether they're what their age is, whether they're older, particularly if they're over 65, and particularly over 75 kind of increases their risk for AFib-related strokes, whether they have diabetes, and certainly whether they've had a stroke in the past. Those are the ones that are increased risk, and certainly patients as they get older are higher risk performing this arrhythmia called AFib. Really, the risk for AFib goes up after the age of 70.
To make an appointment with Dr. Ice, 609-621-2080 by phone, 609-621-2080, or on the web at demanddebora.org, demanddebora.org. In terms of someone that would go in and they would meet and discuss things, is there anything by way of preliminary things that you do to ascertain suitability and all these different things? How does that work?
Well, I think first evaluation for this procedure starts with a simple clinic visit for discussion of the reasons on why a patient may be seeking this out or may be a good candidate for it. Certainly have to confirm that they do have atrial fibrillation, as this isn't necessarily indicated for any reason why they're on blood thinners, but specifically for AFib patients. Oftentimes we'll need some sort of imaging beforehand to make sure that the appendage is the appropriate size and to allow us to successfully close it. And that's most commonly done with a cardiac CT or a CT of the heart prior to the procedure. Certainly we have a group team of different specialty physicians that all meet to review patients beforehand to make sure that they're suitable for the procedure.
Regarding AFib, can AFib be cured or can AFib be treated?
Ultimately, once someone's in AFib, they have an increased risk for staying in AFib even when it is treated. Mm. I guess it's arguable whether it can be cured. Certainly we have options for treatment, whether it be with medications or with procedures where we go in and essentially ablate inside the heart to stop the atrial fibrillation. But even when we do that, there are chances where the AFib may return at some point. So I guess the safe answer is to say we can effectively treat AFib. Whether we're actually curing it or not, I guess, is debatable.
I was very curious about that because I had no idea what you were going to say there. Now, regarding AFib, can one that takes care of, you know, their business and they're doing the right things and so on and so forth, and when you talk with your patients about, you know, what they do going forward and all of this, can you live a normal life expectancy with AFib?
I think when AFib is caught early and treated effectively, I think patients can go on living their normal lives with normal expectancy. They can maintain their normal activities. But again, this comes with appropriate medical care, appropriate follow-up. There's no reason to think that they can't do the things that they want to do.
I wanted to follow up on that because I think sometimes people, lay people like us, not experts and geniuses like you, but us lay people, we think about, like, we hear about there's a heart issue. So that makes you think, like, oh, my God, I'm afraid, like, to get my heart rate up. I'm afraid to do exercise. I'm afraid to do these things because they're actually afraid that it's going to hurt them. Now, I'm just speaking in general terms because, obviously, case by case, you know, you would be much more specific about it. But generally speaking, you do want to work the muscle, right? You do want to do things that contribute towards being healthy, correct?
Correct. You want to do all those things to give yourself exercise, to work the heart, to work your body, to keep your blood pressure low, cholesterol low. There's a lot of lifestyle choices for us that we make that reduce the risk for many diseases and medical conditions. And certainly maintaining a healthy lifestyle goes a long way.
You know, we hear and read things like high blood pressure is a silent killer because people can have it and not even know it, so on and so forth. Of course, if you're doing a regular annual checkup and some other things, you shouldn't. I don't think it should sneak up on you if you're paying attention, but a lot of people don't. And so, you deal with what is, not what should be. But regarding stroke, are there things that people can do to help their cause to not ultimately have a stroke? What would you say relative to a general but I think important question like that?
Yeah, certainly. I think there are things to do to reduce one's risk for stroke, and that has to do with reducing all the risk factors that we know that potentially increase one's risk for stroke. Blood pressure is a major one that you mentioned. Certainly keeping on top of that, as blood pressure goes up or average blood pressure goes up, the risk for stroke goes up, about 5 to 10 times as we continue to get higher and higher in blood pressure. So it's extremely important to make sure that we're controlling those risk factors, such as blood pressure, that we're getting seen by our physicians and staying on top of that. It can be very silent, and people go many years without even noticing. And so that's why routine visits to your doctor is essential.
To make an appointment, 609-621-2080, 609-621-2080, or on the web, demanddebora.org, demanddebora.org. We're with Dr. Ice, and we're talking about understanding AFib and stroke. Regarding AFib, I know I mentioned earlier I used the word familial. Is heredity a big factor in terms of AFib? In other words, could someone eat well, exercise, do all the right things, but it's just in the sort of the heredity, the familial cards, and you get it? Is family history a big issue here?
It can to some extent, but as we kind of talked about before, you can still do many of the things you should be doing from a lifestyle standpoint. And as we get older, our risk for AFib still continues to go up. And so, as I mentioned before, particularly after the age of 70, that risk goes up. So if you live long enough, you may end up having AFib no matter what you do. But it still gives us responsibility to sort of decrease those risks as much as we can.
Is this the kind of thing, AFib, for example, where whatever we're at, 370 million Americans, whatever the number is, I'm not exactly sure, but that's probably good as any guess. Is this something that afflicts millions of Americans?
It does. Millions of Americans have atrial fibrillation. That number continues to increase every year. But I think most importantly is we continue to have a better understanding of atrial fibrillation as well as options for treating it. So I think we're moving in a positive direction in that regard.
Sometimes, you know, we've done segments where different things, you know, like you might get like a heart flutter and all of a sudden you go to your doctor because you say, this is happening, this funny little feeling, fluttering and stuff. All right, well, we're going to look at it. You know, we'll go through whatever devices, lab or whatever, and see that, you have palpitations or something. Is there anything with AFib that by way of sort of symptoms presents in an individual?
There are several symptoms that an AFib patient may have. Sometimes, though, they may have zero symptoms. They may be asymptomatic. They may not notice that they're even in it until they're seen, until they have a physical exam or an EKG that demonstrates that they have it. But for those patients who do have symptoms, it can be a variety of symptoms such as shortness of breath. They may have palpitations that you mentioned. In some cases, it may just be simply fatigue that they've noticed. They just don't feel the way they used to feel. So they feel a little bit off. And so it can be some chest discomfort. It can be a variety of symptoms. And that's why when someone's noticing something that's off, it's important to go see their physician about that.
Closing comment, and I think it's not a scared straight type of thing, but I think it's important as a point of emphasis. Someone that has this that lets it go untreated, what are the downsides to that, what I would think would be unwise strategy?
Well, there's certainly the risk for stroke. So if it went untreated and you weren't treating some of the secondary stroke related, that's an issue. But certainly as we leave AFib, what we have gathered over the past 10 or 15 years of treating this is that it can create changes in the heart. Certain areas of the heart can become enlarged, and that can increase risk for other types of disorders. And so we're slowly learning that treating it early is the best course of action.
And that's our program on understanding AFib and stroke on Deborah Heart and Lung Center presents Dr. Daniel Ice. To make an appointment, 609-621-2080 if you would like to speak to a scheduling representative, or you can do so on the web at demanddeborah.org. I always enjoy our time together, Dr. Ice. Thank you so much for your expertise.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Harry.
Honor to be with you, sir.